This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. From Annie Hall's La-Di-Da to Tony Montana's Little Friend in Scarface, Jesse Gilmore did not get your ordinary high school education. After he almost flunked out and made it clear that he absolutely hated school, his dad, David, offered him a deal. He could drop out, live at home, job and rent free, and all he had to do in exchange was to watch 3 movies a week with his old man. Over the course of more than 100 films, father and son had time to talk about movies, yes, but also about girls and heartbreak, about drugs and cigarettes, about chewing with your mouth open, and about the choices we make in life, topics that a lot of teenagers don't discuss with their fathers. David Gilmore and his son Jesse join us in a moment to share their stories. If you'd like to talk with them about their unconventional homeschooling, or if you learned something important about life from a particular movie, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, high school and college yearbooks may pass into oblivion soon. But first, the film club. David Gilmore is a visiting professor of literary studies at the University of Toronto. His book about his son's unusual education is called The Film Club, and he joins us from the studios of DB Audio in Toronto, Canada. Nice to have you on the program with us today.
It's very nice to be here, Neil.
And didn't it make you nervous to let your son drop out of school?
It really made me enormously. For a year, I tried not to do it. For a year, I kind of sat at the kitchen table and did all his homework for him and all his assignments. And I thought, I can't countenance the notion of a young man not having a high school education, because I grew up in a tradition where you were told, correctly or not, that if you didn't get a university education, you were going to end up living in a box somewhere in Los Angeles. So, yeah, I was completely mortified. And then it took me another, once I actually let him drop out of school, you know, you're kidding yourself if you think you can force a 6'4" teenage boy to go to school. You're deluding yourself. But even once I let him out, for a year and a half, I woke up with what appeared to be sort of angina pectoris, some form of heart attack in the middle of the night, thinking, I have been so hip that I've let my son drop out of school and watch these movies. And in the course of being so hip, I've also ruined his life.
Well, he tells you after some months, when I was in school, I worried about bad grades and getting into trouble. Now that I'm not in school, I worry that maybe I've ruined my life. And I can feel your stomach dropping out of your body at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. You know, how irresponsible a man can you possibly be, so that not only do you mismanage your own life so that you essentially end up without a job at the age of 50, but then you actually end up watching essentially movies on the couch with your dropout son. You know, there were days when I looked at this portrait and I thought, this is monumental irresponsibility. But on the other hand, I have to say this, you know, I had a gut feeling that good kids go on to have good lives. And this guy was great. There was nothing wrong with him. He just hated school. That's hardly a pathology.
Jesse Gilmore is also there at DB Audio in Toronto.
Hi there.
Hi, Jesse. And the way your father describes it in the book, when he offers you this deal, you leap into the air, click your heels, spin around 3 times, and celebrate.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was, you know, it was, I really disliked school, and when he told me that I could drop out, I was just ecstatic about it. You know, it was the last couple of years for school for me were really terrible and really kind of damaging to me, I think, at the time. And it kind of turned me into someone who's kind of always worried and a little bit dishonest, worried about getting in trouble, worried about not getting good grades, et cetera, et cetera.
And the part about watching the 3 movies a week, what did you think about that?
I thought, you know, it was something that it came to a real, a formal plan after I'd actually dropped out of school. But watching movies was something that me and my dad had always done together, that we mutually really enjoyed it. We always did it. And so it was, you know, it didn't seem like, oh, this is such a great scam. I get to watch 3 movies with my dad and I don't get to go to school. But, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like I said, look, we're going to do something we've never done before. You know, we're going to collect exotic stamps, or we're going to go and see the museum 3 times a week. I felt really strongly that this bright, nice guy had already been bored to tears by school for a number of years. I thought, why substitute another activity that he hates for the one that he's just done? So what does he like to do? You know, and the fact is, You obviously can't. We're not real athletic guys, you know, so we're not going to go and shoot the puck around. We're not going to go skydiving. And what we are is we're talkers and we're movie watchers. My son wasn't a huge reader either, so I just picked something. You know, what can I do that's going to educate him but at the same time entertain him? Because, you know, believe it or not, it is possible that entertainment and education actually can coexist. So, although, you know, spent enough time in high school and it's hard to believe it.
So you thought entertainment, education, and you showed him Ishtar.
Well, you know, I'm a great defender of Ishtar. Now, I believe that Ishtar is one of the great buried treasures, that I believe Ishtar was savaged by a lot of kind of mean-spirited, myopic critics who really could not forgive Warren Beatty for having too many beautiful girlfriends. They'd waited 25 years to pounce. Along came a movie that was, they said, fiscally in trouble, that was over budget, and they thought, now's the time. If you watch Ishtar, there is a scene with Charles Grodin and Dennis and Dustin Hoffman where they're discussing where Libby is, which is as good comic acting as you will find in any American movie. But for some reason, people were so crawling over themselves to get to hurt Warren that they overlooked the extraordinary qualities of that movie.
You mentioned that unit on buried treasures. Another film you picked was a quiz show, and we're going to listen to a little clip from a scene where they're playing poker.
Whoa. Now I'm impressed.
Go ahead, Dick. Call him. What do you say, Dick?
I know you're lying.
Whoa. Bluffing. The word is bluffing.
A nice scene, Rob Morrow there. Yeah.
How fine is that? That's a Robert Redford film that was directed. And boy, you can feel that when he slips that word, he says, it's not, it's bluffing. It's not lying. It's extraordinary. And as I said in the book, you can, the scene is shot just looking at Ray Fiennes' eyes. And the paranoia, it's like reading a Russian novel. It really is like watching Raskolnikov in the office with the inspector as the inspector is slowly turning the knot tighter and tighter on his throat.
And the thing you said before about watching Ishtar, which was what made the film club so great, was that we watched everything from Fellini to Ishtar and everything in between, you know, because what, and as my dad said, and I believe, we didn't want just a completely intellectualized academic film class. You know, part of the great joys of watching films are watching the movies that are really fun to watch and really enjoyable, and you're not always, you know, talking about shots and camera angles and, you know, great monologues.
Yeah, like the real film devotee has got to be able to get off on a terrible movie.
Yeah,
I mean, there
absolutely.
Are great, I mean, I'm not talking about Ishtar, although Ishtar does have a little narrative dip in the middle. I admit when they get to the desert, the story slows down, but my
that
point
middle
is
hour,
that, you know,
yeah.
That middle hour, well, that's rather, but in that middle hour, that's the exquisite scene with Dustin Hoffman and Charles Grodin. So it's worth that part right there. But yeah, I rather snobbishly hold. See, I didn't want a film weenie to come out of this club, some kid that couldn't talk about anything but Kurosawa or Fellini. I wanted somebody who embraced and loved all films, who could look at Basic Instinct and understand why Basic Instinct in its awfulness is still kind of thrilling and enormously watchable.
If you put it in, you know, in the metaphor of it being education, Basic Instinct would be the equivalent of, you know, like a spare or the lunch break, you know? You have, you know, Fellini first period and Kurosawa last period. In the middle, you get Basic Instinct Showgirls because you need a little... Those movies are fun in their own way, the Kurosawa, but they're not, you know, I'm not going to lie and say they're as fun as watching Showgirls. They're something different. They're deep and they're profound, but are they as fun as Basic Instinct? I don't think so.
A well-balanced diet, though, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Who wants a teenager who only watches Fellini? I can't think of it. I wouldn't want to spend 5 minutes with a kid like that. I'd want him in prison.
We're talking with David and Jesse Gilmore about David's book, The Film Club, about Jesse's unusual education where he watched movies with his father after his father let him drop out of high school. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Steve's calling us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi. When I was in college, part of my my degree was film studies, and I was really fascinated and found it to be something that was really useful, actually. But in an academic setting, you know, there's a lot more structure. You're forced to go through all of these different film critics. I kind of want to know, how did you go through, you know, learning about the films and you know, drawing how to talk about them? Did you, you know, just go through and develop your own way of thinking and speaking about them? Or did
I should point out David Kilmore, also a novelist, broadcaster, and critic, so he knew a little bit something about the movies before he started this.
Well, sure. The two of you, how did you develop this kind of way to talk about the films?
Yeah, that's a good question.
As I said before, we'd always talked about movies. You know, with anyone learning anything at the beginning, you know, for the first, you know, little while, you just mimic the teacher's opinions, you know, which is kind of what happened, which I think any young man, especially with his father, does. But because I was shown so many movies and my dad was a film critic and knew real film analysis, after a little while, you actually start to pick up on things yourself and you start to get your own ideas and your own criteria for what... Sorry?
I was just going to say, David, there's that wonderful moment in your book where you say to your son, you know, you could be a film critic, and you then give him a little oral exam.
Oh, yeah, because the thing about Jesse was that because I came to this as a film critic, and a rather undistinguished film critic, I might add, I loathe false modesty. I'm not being – the problem is when I was a critic, I was too self-conscious of how I should be talking about films, how I should be perceiving them. While I was a film critic, I lost the direct experience of the movies. In other words, just me and the experience of the movie. When I started to watch movies with Jesse, he had no such snobism. So his response to these movies was visceral and, in a way, much more trustworthy than mine. So it was a kind of pleasant reciprocity because I brought out all these films and said, look, this is a real great classic. You have to watch this. And he'd watch it and he'd go, actually, that's kind of a dull film. And I would catch myself thinking, you know, I've always thought that was a rather dull film, but it was so unfashionable for a film critic to say about, you know, something from the Nouvelle Vague that it was essentially a dull film, or that Godard really can be as boring as a concussion. It kind of took a 16-year-old like Jesse to look at these films and say, but this is excruciating torture, Dad. You're not going to make me watch the rest of this, are you?
Steve, thanks very much for the call. When we come back, we'll talk with David and Jesse Gilmore about some of their other study units in their film program, Talent Will Out, and Buried Treasures. We mentioned horror and, that Nouvelle Vague whole category. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. David Gilmore offered his son an unusual curriculum after it became clear that he hated high school. His teachers, Hitchcock, Godard, and Scorsese. His classmates, Clint, Woody, and Jack. David Gilmore's memoir joins us today. His book is called The Film Club, and you can read about the day he actually realized he had lost what he calls the school battle with his teenage son in an excerpt on our website at npr.org/talk. Jesse Gilmore, David's son, is also with us today. We want to hear from you. If you learned something important from a particular movie, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can check out that blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's go to Heidi. Heidi with us from Louisville in Kentucky.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. David, I just wanted to salute you for what you've done. That's amazing, and what a wonderful gift to give your son. One of my favorite films of all time is To Kill a Mockingbird. It still is upholding... protecting the innocent, upholding equality, just a wonderful message. I was just wondering, I was wondering how much I'm really damaged by seeing those Dracula movies and the Wolfman movies when I was a kid. Because I know I wouldn't show my daughter the scary stuff now, but, you know, it just our parents let us watch that stuff, and I'm just wondering what the impact may have been.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a little bit neurotic and a little tiny bit oversensitive when it comes to movies, and I can't stand horror movies, and I'm 58 years old now, and I still can't stand horror movies. So I respond so strongly to movies that I believe that they can hurt you, and they can hurt you for a long time. And so I was a little bit selective about things that I didn't want to wound my son. I think there are things that that, you know, a certain kind of sexually explicit film, I think that that can bruise your soul. It can coarsen your soul. And not only that, I wanted to make really clear that we were not running some men's locker room here. You know, we were going to be winking and watching a whole bunch of guy films. So I kept a kind of, you know, the thing with my son is, you know, we're not friends, he and I. Like, I always get a bit nervous when parents say, oh, my son is my best friend. We're really not. My son is my son, and I'm his father. And that was a line that we really never crossed.
And about the horror movies, I think in the book, the most terrifying movie we watched was The Exorcist.
Oh,
and there were two of them, actually, Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. And the interesting thing about The Exorcist, in Rosemary's Baby, at the end, when they never show the baby, because obviously a trick for all art is if you don't show it, your imagination will make it 10 times more terrifying. Except in the case of The Exorcist, when you go in that room and you see that little girl, it is more terrifying than anything you could have imagined. And that's what makes that movie so terrifying and so, in a way, profoundly terrifying and primordial.
There's something of the great art about that movie. I think its director, William Friedkin, was actually a great artist who was sort of destroyed by his own vanity and by the flaws of his own personality. But when he did The French Connection and The Exorcist, you are, I think, seeing a great artist at the top of his swing. And there is an evocation of terror in there that's almost primordial. It's almost as if you shouldn't experience it directly. And I had second thoughts about showing my son that movie, but I felt like this was an example of truly great art, and as such, he should embrace it. Of course, your response was less cowardly than mine.
Yeah,
I was the one cringing behind the door.
And those movies, strangely, as you get older, they become more terrifying.
Yes, yeah, I can testify to that.
Jesse, you were considerably thicker skinned than I was when we were watching these movies. He was quite thick skinned.
But I don't think now, at 22, I could make it through that movie. Yeah,
right.
It came on TV the other day, and as soon as, you know, you heard those growls from the little girl's room, I had to turn it off.
The man's voice coming from the little girl's mouth is one of the great moments of cinematic horror. It's inexplicably horrifying.
Heidi, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
They mentioned girls, and much of the book is taken up with Jesse's heartbreak over two particular girls. And there's a movie, David, that you picked to show him, and we're going to, of course, rake this all over and embarrass him on national radio.
We don't
have
the girls on here on the line.
That's
you know?
Right. They're joining us now.
Good.
But there was a moment, David, when you showed your son American Graffiti, and particularly pointed out this scene where Richard Dreyfuss sees Suzanne Summers drive away in that fabulous convertible.
What did you say?
Wait, what did you say? What did you say? Quick, hang a right.
What? Why?
Steven, cut over to G Street. I just saw a vision. I saw a goddess. Come on, you gotta catch up to her.
I see anything.
Come on, Kurt. We can't be spending half the night chasing girls down for you.
Maury, I'm telling you, this was the most perfect, dazzling creature I've ever seen.
Gone. Get it.
She spoke to me. She spoke to me right through the window. I think she said, I love you.
That's such a fine movie.
Yeah.
Great film.
Such a fine movie. And, you know, and a remarkable, I mean, profound is a word that film critics use way too often. That movie is quite profound because it's about that very thing, about the fact that so much of your youth is spent believing that real life is somewhere else. And that true love and beauty exists in someone. And if you can just have her, you can somehow be at the center of the universe. And as we get older, we learn, alas, that actually there is no center of the universe.
Which is another thing, actually, near the end of the film club, when you showed me 8 1/2 with Fellini,
right,
which is an older man whose his entire life has been looking, in 8 1/2, has been looking for a woman to finally make him happy, to put him at the center of the universe. And his realization at the end of the movie, Marco Mastroianni, is that no woman can ever make you happy. In the end,
absolutely,
only you can make you happy.
And there, you know, there is that, you know, and I don't want to bore your listeners and you know, because, you know, people can get awfully precious talking about movies, you know, but there is a kind of Proustian idea about, you know, can you have somebody and still desire them, or is in fact our possession and desire incompatible? And that is an issue, believe it or not, that's addressed in American Graffiti. And for my son, and I don't want to embarrass him, but this is a few years back, he's recovered from these girls. I assume you have.
Yeah, I hope so.
But I did have a feeling that there was a significant lesson to be learned from the film, because it seemed to me that he desired these young women a great deal more after they were gone than he actually did when he had them in his life. And I tried rather impotently to show him that this was actually the nature of romantic love, which it often has to do with desire and unavailability, and that he was in fact suffering not for what he'd lost, but for what he could no longer have.
Desire, unavailability, and convertibles. Let's get Jim on the line. Jim is with us from Uchi in Oklahoma. Jim, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi. Hey, this is a good program. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Well, thank you.
I wonder, y'all surely watch Chinatown.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
De rigueur.
Yeah, there's a bunch of good lessons there for the hero. Keep on trudging on regardless of the odds. And I just wondered what you and your son took away from Chinatown.
You know, to tell you the absolute, what I took away from Chinatown, I'm not sure. You know, movies touch different people in different ways.
Sure.
But what I got from that was just the brilliance of Jack Nicholson's acting, you know. And
tremendous.
Chinatown I really enjoyed. It wasn't a movie that really, really touched me. But it is a great movie.
And you see, for me, it was the exhilaration of truth. Like, you forget how great a director Roman Polanski really, really was. And when you watch that movie frame by frame, that movie gleams with talent. It just leaps right off the screen at you. And you know, and you remember the famous scene where Ruth Gordon in Rosemary's Baby is partly obscured by a door, and we're trying to see her. She's having a conversation with someone, and you first of all think that Polanski's made a mistake. He's put the camera in the wrong part of the room, that we should be able to see into the room and see what she's doing. And then you realize in Rosemary's Baby that this is part of the film's overall extraordinary paranoia, that the viewer is never allowed to actually see who is in the room talking on the phone or hear what she's saying. Those kinds of touches mean that a director has thought a great deal about that particular moment. Chinatown was at the top of Polanski's swing, where the remarkable artistry of the choices, from the strange Band-Aid on Jack Nicholson's nose to its strange, rather gothic ending. That ending has always wounded me. I can't figure out if it's great art or a man actually in contempt of his audience. I've never really been able to decide, because every time I watch Chinatown, I expect, like Romeo and Juliet, I always want Juliet to wake up at the end, and I expect that she will, and I always expect and always hope that Chinatown is going to end differently than it does.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Jim.
All right. Thank you. Nice program.
So long. Let's see if we can go now to Terry. Terry's with us from Kansas City.
Hi.
Hi, Terry.
I wanted to talk a bit about Fight Club.
This, interestingly, this was a film I watched a couple of times with my son, so go ahead.
Oh, great.
Yeah, the first thing I learned about Fight Club is that you don't talk about Fight Club.
Uh-huh.
And then I learned about, you know, consumerism and the way that people perceive me and the way that I perceive myself may not be the same thing, you know, with the duality between Ed Norton and
Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt, yeah.
It's a deeper film than most people think.
And you just whispered High School Dropout.
Yeah, because we were talking about that on the way over here. That one of the wounding things that Jesse had in the early stages of experience were, you know, was the perception of
people. The perception of you know, when, and you talk about that duality, the perception of everyone when I dropped out of school saying, oh, this guy's such a loser, or this guy's lazy, which really, I have to say, wasn't the case. It had nothing to do with that. And the idea that because you're one thing, you're automatically the other thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was very difficult, because you know, when Jesse left school, you know, there were people who looked at him like, well, you know, you've really flunked out. Now you've really ruined his life. And what people didn't see or didn't want to see was that in fact he was a much happier young man, and that he literally, the color had returned to his face, that it was actually good for him. And there were a lot of examples of people, you know, people passing judgment on him in a very inaccurate and in a very damaging way.
But Fight Club is an absolute blast of a movie, you know, written by Chuck Palahniuk, who also wrote another book called Lullaby. Very dark stuff about this lullaby that you read to children and they die. He's a very, very dark writer. But Fight Club is so stylish, and I can't say this on the radio, but anyone who knows the scene where Brad Pitt gets up and crosses Edward Norton and says, "Now a question of etiquette," on the airplane, you know, I can't repeat it, but if you've seen the movie, you know the scene.
Sure.
Just really slick writing. And Brad Pitt's most stylish, most, you know, you see that, you know, it's a complete comic book character. That character doesn't exist, but I guess that's the point. But it's so stylish, and, you know, smoking a cigarette in the bathtub. You know?
Brad Pitt kind of suffers, and also, you know, Brad Pitt kind of suffers from the Robert Redford syndrome, which is that he's so good looking, there are people who simply will not give him a break. And if you see Brad's acting in Babel, which was that exquisite Mexican movie.
You watch Babel, and you see that there, it's, I'm not sure who's listening who's seen Babel, I'm sure a lot of people.
A lot of people.
When he's just gone through this entire drama with his wife getting shot, and he finally gets back to the airport and he talks to his child, and right in the middle of the conversation he bursts into tears, and it's like a kid who's been holding it up all day at school and finally gets home to his mother and starts crying, and it's a really heartbreaking scene.
Oh, you're so right. You're absolutely so right.
And one of the things I learned watching it with my son was, if you just ask questions afterwards, why did you like that so much, you learn a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
Terry,
yes,
thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with David and Jesse Gilmore about David's book, The Film Club. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in. Billy from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks, Billy.
Great for me. Just me and my dad have, I mean, I'm a dropout, and I've watched so many movies with my dad. I've gotten so much education through movies with my dad. It's amazing.
Oh, right on.
But I guess my comment is... The Godfather, of course.
Amen.
There's more education than that. Like he said, in those words, my dad said, there's more education than this. He said books. He's a little older. But he, of course, agrees with the movie. I mean, the movie is the movie. But he says, there's more education. I can underline passages in this book for you to, like, that this is life. This is what, and, like, just like what we actually talked about it the other day, talking to Tom, the consigliere,
Robert Duvall. Yeah.
Well, he says to Michael, consider this. You're talking to the most powerful person in the world, pretty much as far as their world goes. And you're telling him what to do, but instead of telling him what to do, consider this and how far you can get with people if you just ask them to consider this instead of pushing it on them.
Billy, the great thing is that you've sort of hit on a point, which is, you know, Jesse and I watched a whole bunch of films together, and then we went out on the porch and we talked initially about the films, but the conversations went really further afield. But now that the film club is over, you know, now that I realize that really what was as important as anything we did or anything we watched was how much time we spent together, is that, you know, that most fathers, for a variety of reasons, good and excusable, they just don't have a whole lot of time to spend with teenage boys. And teenage boys often don't think that they want to spend time with their dads. And as I look back on the film club, you know, what I'm really grateful for is I'm happy we saw, and we must have seen about 300 or 350 films, but it's the time, because you never get to have that time again.
Yeah, you never end. But as far as what you're saying, Billy, the education from that movie, I think one of the mainstay, you know, when Francis Ford Coppola made that movie, he, you know, what he directed before was two or three B movies. Dementia 13 was one of them. And they gave this young guy, all part of the American New Wave with Scorsese and Brian De Palma and all these guys. And the only way he could get it made was say, listen, this is a movie about corporate greed. And in a way it is, because the main point of that movie, for me anyway, is watching Al Pacino's corruption from the beginning to the very end of part two, which is just the, it transcends sex and it transcends family and it transcends love. And it's just a want for more power and more power till power doesn't even mean anything anymore. And it's like a drug.
And see what I mean? The guy should be a film critic.
And
he
in
really
fact, went back to high school, got his degree and is now studying what, Jesse?
I'm going to film school next year in Prague because I want to be a filmmaker. I want to actually make movies myself.
David, what have you wrought?
Oh, I know. No, listen, believe me. You know, when I look in the mirror, I think, you know, I know it's old-fashioned to say this, but why couldn't he have been a doctor or a lawyer? I think, I can't believe this. It's like,
what a
like
disappointment.
A filmmaker. Oh, well, I mean, I'm thrilled. I think it takes nerves like crazy, and I think one of the things he got out of the film club was the courage. He first of all had the courage to leave high school in the face of real criticism. Now he's got the courage to go to Prague and go to film school. There's a job with a lot of security. To it.
David and Jesse Gilmore, thanks to you both, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Neil. That was great.
The book we're talking about is David Gilmore's The Film Club, and they joined us from DB Studios, Audio Studios in Toronto, Canada. When we come back, we're going to be talking about what could be a vanishing object of American life, the yearbook. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.